1967, we awoke. Awoke to the knowledge of the village. Now, 50 years on, we invite you, good citizens, to join us in celebrating the timeless topics, eloquent prose, and striking visuals of the iconic programme, The Prisoner.
Welcome to the Eternal Village Cast, a program of conversations with those who created, those who've contributed to the canon, and those who cherish the brilliant and influential program, The Prisoner. Attention, Communications Department. Please open a secure Priority One connection with the Watchmaker's Daughter. Good people, we are honored to share a conversation with the gifted thespian, talented journalist, and passionate activist, Ms. Annette Andre.
So Annette, thank you so much for joining us today.
Welcome. I'm very happy to be here.
I'm so thrilled you are. The idea of a book can be daunting. What I'm curious about is the seed of where the notion came from to write this book. What were some of the motivations that drove you to put pen to paper to begin this process?
Very simple. Very simple, really. I think it was some years ago. I'd been trying to think what my parents had done before they had me, and I knew a little bit about them. They were working class people, and I thought, what did my mother do before she had me? And I remember her saying to me at some point, oh, well, I did a bit of hairdressing. I hated it. And then never went any further than that. Because we didn't have, in those days, you were seen and not heard. And you didn't ask a lot of questions because that wasn't polite. And so we didn't have really open chats. I think in those days, a lot of people were very hindered about doing that, unless you were very sophisticated and open-minded. My parents were wonderful, but they didn't open up and sort of go into details about what their previous life was. I knew a little bit about how my mother went to school and, all those things. I haven't a clue what my father, how he went to school. Did he have a long way to go or not or whatever? And I have a daughter who we have a very strong and open relationship. And I suddenly thought to myself, she knows a lot about me, but she doesn't know a hell of a lot about my early life, growing up, my parents, the relations, what we did, and certain things that were actually, I thought, that's quite a good story. But I think I'll write a journal so she'll have something to look at, and my grandchildren. Anyway, that's how it started. And, of course, after a time, it actually turned into a book. I had no aspirations to write a book, believe me. Writing's not something I particularly want to do.
But it is a skill that you've employed, because I've heard your broadcasts on Siren FM, and you do write eloquent pieces there. So I have to believe that the idea of composing didn't come completely new. This is a skill you've had in motion for a while, correct?
Yes, I have been doing those, and I collect, sort of interesting stories or whatever to do. And my husband, who is a writer, is very good with me. He's guided me a lot. And I didn't know the first thing about how do you write something you want to write in that many lines or words. So he's instructed me a lot in how to compose a thing, how you judge what you do. And then in terms of the book, he is editing my book. So without him, it would be, I'd be a lost soul, but he guides me a great deal and criticizes me a lot and makes me redo and all that sort of thing. So, you know, I do have a guiding light behind me.
That's absolutely marvelous. But when looking at any story, our own story, a fictional story, they say that the challenge is knowing how to put the pieces together. Where do they all go? How did you decide in what format to lay out the story of your life in terms of some authors do it chronological, some do it by characters or milestones? How did you take on that task of dividing the whole into the pieces?
I have no idea. I mean, it started as a mess.
Yeah.
And Arthur asked me those questions, actually, my husband, and said, how do you want to do this? You know, you've got to think about this. Oh, do I? You know, I've read a few. I'm not big on reading autobiographies, but I have read a few, and the ones I've read, most of them have been absolutely wonderful, and some haven't. And what I didn't want to do was do the, well, I started at such and such, and then I went on to there, and then I did this, and then I did that.
Mm-hmm.
The chronological thing, which
right.
I thought, in my case, was not interesting. Some people can do that because it's paths leading to a definite point. But I think, particularly as an actor, your paths can lead you all over the place. So, you know, chronologically it doesn't work. And I decided from having read an autobiography that was not chronological, I thought that's what I'd like to do. I'd just like to help, you know, to start there. And certainly you've got to start at a point and try to piece it together. And that's Arthur was a big help there because he'd read it and say, I don't think you should have that chapter there. Think about it, you know. So it's been murder, actually.
Yeah.
It has been a long, long and rough ride.
Yeah, and I have to imagine that one of the most challenging questions you ask yourself every day is, does this go in the book? Because in a life led as you have, with all the things you've contributed and given to the world, the problem is you can't create a 10-volume book to start with. You have to make those tough choices. Has that been a challenge?
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely. Because I tend to want to, if I'm telling a story, I want to go into different details and do this and, you know, make it this and make it that. And that's where Arthur guided me with the talks. He'd say, you can't do all that. No, you've got to reduce it. You've got to cut to the chase. You can't just ramble on. And
right.
And so that started me thinking about all of that. And you do have to really cut it down and say, now, what is important in this? And is this an important piece that I want to put in here? Or is it irrelevant? Or doesn't it have any particular sort of, you know, sense or even a little laugh or something? I'm trying to get some humor into it. And it's, I've been befuddled on many, many occasions, I have to tell you. Yeah.
Is there also a question, because of course, yes, humor and the idea of pathos, but is there any question you have to struggle with in terms of vulnerability? Telling
yes.
something that, you know, maybe you know will share an idea with someone, but you also have to literally lay yourself out on the page to say those stories.
That has been a big, big sort of mountain to cross. There have been many occasions I've ended up in tears, I must say, you know, thinking about things, because you tend to then get hold of something you're writing about, and then you start looking back. Why did I do that? Or why did I say that? Or what can I do? And then you start, you know, festering. It starts roiling around in your stomach, and you start thinking, oh, I did so. And you've got to get over that because it's in the past.
Yes.
You know, you can't
yes.
do anything about the past, and you do lay yourself open. I have done that in the book. I had to make some choices and say, do I really want to say this? But if you're going to write a book like this, one of the first things I said to Arthur is when I do this, it's going to be very hard, isn't it? Because I've got to be honest. He said, you have to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, and that is hard because you want to go back and change things, or you want to change you, or you say, gosh, I didn't like myself there. That's a no. Or other times when you say, oh, well, that wasn't too bad. No, it's been a really difficult path, very difficult and very painful at times, very painful.
Well, if it helps at all, I do read a lot of biographies. I've always felt that the greatest stories are the ones we live. And when it comes to folks and people who are public, like you are, I've always found that the vulnerability reminds me how I want to use the right word, how common or how connected we all are when you understand that people we see in a limelight actually have had challenges or pain or suffering. Because it's too easy, especially I think in years past, where maybe sometimes people's pain wasn't shown, to think, oh, well, that person's completely gilded and they have no hardship. But all of us do have something we have to overcome.
Absolutely. A lot of people can't face it and can't put it out there. And I think the ones that do go through a lot of suffering. But in many ways, it is a clearing of the soul or the mind or the heart or whatever it is. Yeah. I think it can provide. You look back and you say, okay, that's out there now. That's what it is. People will either like it or not, and that's who I am.
Mm-hmm. And the author must be true to herself to begin with. Now, process. Let's talk about the fun of process. Are you composing this in your computer? Are you a typist? Are you doing this by hand? How are you getting the thoughts from an eclectic mind onto that scary thing that's a white blank piece of paper?
Handwriting.
Interesting. Okay.
Handwriting. Yes, handwriting. And get it all done. Better if I can see it on the page.
Yeah.
And then cross something out and, you know, do them. And then if I've got it, it's a nuisance when you've got to do it over. Of course, I've had to do things over a lot. And Arthur edits, and he does handwriting too, because he won't touch a computer. I actually have a computer, but he doesn't. And so we've got the handwritten notes. And what happened was, I said, oh gosh, I don't think I can sit at a computer and type all this up, you know, and go through my notes and do all that. I thought, oh gosh, I can't just sit at a computer like that. I don't do that sort of thing. And so we thought, okay, we'll get somebody, you know, to transcribe it for us.
Right.
Well, trying to find somebody to take your notes and do them is impossible. We tried a whole lot of people here. We tried students. We tried, senior centers. Because you think, well, there are people who don't want to sit around all day. They've retired and things, but they know how to type or do a computer, and they'd be happy to have a little bit of work for a while. So nothing happened. And then Rick Davey, who you spoke to today, who is publishing the book, he found a lovely woman to do it. So she started off. I had typed up a few things on the computer. So we then recorded onto tapes and sent them to Rick, and he gave them to her, and she transcribed from some tapes and then emailed them back, and I went through them and edited them, and, you know, they were quite good, but few mistakes.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, something happened to him, and she was unable to continue. She'd done a few chapters, but seriously not enough. And I understood completely, poor girl. So we're left. And I had just bought, I don't have iPhones and things. I've got a little cell phone that I carry for an emergency, but I don't have an iPhone. I never use it over here. In London I would, but not over here so much. And but I bought an iPad. This was just a couple of months ago. Because someone said, oh, you'll enjoy an iPad. You can put your photos on there. And people are sometimes saying, oh, let me see your grandkids, or do you have a photograph? And you can show them on that. So I did. I got the iPhone. And I went to Apple, And I had a few lessons on what to do and how to do it, because I didn't have a clue. I mean, you know that I'm not very electronically minded. So that went very well. And then they showed me how to use this thing called Siri, where you can talk and you can tell it how to write your emails and things, and came out. And I looked at this, and then there was a thing called Pages, which is their idea of Word. And you can talk into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I learned how to do that, and that's how I've done it. I have my little iPad here, and I set it up, and I talk into it. I mean, you have to learn the technique, because at first it was making so much gobbledygook because it didn't understand what I was saying a whole lot of times. And then you suddenly realize that it's a computer, so you've got to be a computer. And you've got to be, you've got to talk to it in computer not language, but sound. So you talk like this, and you sound out every word that you say.
Yes.
And at the time of a cat that sat on the mat, you know, that sort of thing. And it works beautifully. I still have to edit, and it does come out with gobbledygook sometimes, but it's understandable, you know, when you can just cut into it and edit it on the computer. Yeah.
And the funny and almost audacious thing is that you said, I'm not good with technology, yet you just described finding a problem, looking for resources, learning, managing, and mastering the technology. I think you're quite the technologist, young lady.
Well, I don't think I am, but I think I was just smart there.
Yeah.
I think the computer brain, I understood the computer brain, that you just become what do you call them? You know, little things that talk funny. Like Daleks, no. What are they called? I have a senior moment. I can't think
of
the word.
Little robots.
Robots, that's the word.
Yeah.
That's the word. Robot talk, that's what you've got to do.
I think that would make a perfect epilogue to the book, is the story of you learning that whole process to make this something that the rest of us can enjoy.
I think I'll just keep it for my interviews or talking about how I did it.
Got it. So did you set down with an objective of how many, as they say, words to write or pages, or was it fluid in terms of where you started?
Oh, yeah, I just didn't have a clue about anything like that. I mean, as far as I was concerned, you just took up a pen and paper and said, okay, I'm going to write a book. Here we go.
Got it.
And out of the mess has hopefully come some sort of a book.
It absolutely has.
I think actually quite a good book, I hope.
Everyone will be excited to read it. Now, in helping you to compose that, obviously you have this great guide of Arthur, who is an author. That's great.
Yes.
Did you also tap into using, let's say, old scrapbooks, old journals, old diaries, things to, when looking back, trigger memories or things to remind you of chapters and episodes?
Oh, yes. That played a big part. Luckily, I had kept quite a lot, and they had reviews, so I thought, oh, yes, that's right. That did go quite well. Or they'd tell me where I was playing, and say if I was on a tour, and I had programs, and I was able to look up who was in the cast a lot of the time, so I could make some sort of reference or what character, because you can't remember everything, at least I couldn't.
No.
You know, I couldn't remember who I played in that play or that episode or something else. So I did get quite a lot of help from old and programs and scraps, you know, scrapbooks, and then on the computer for the television and film stuff, which they think, and I could look up people.
Yeah, we are blessed with having so much information now in terms of at least the chronology and when things happen. That does help.
Yes. Oh, yes, it helps a lot because, you know, I mean, my diaries really didn't put in everything, and certainly there were a lot of things in my diaries. I thought, why on earth didn't I put some more details in there so I could remember who this person, there's a name, but who was it? And, what did they do? And then I think I might have recollected a couple after that. And I thought, oh, my gosh, that's really interesting. Why didn't I put more in about that? Why was I meeting there? And so things, yeah. If I came back again, I'd probably keep better diaries just in case. Right. And then, of course, I wouldn't write a book. So, you know.
We could just publish the diaries. That would be easy.
Yes.
Will the book include several favorite photos? Are you planning to do it in that kind of an illustrated fashion?
We are, yes. Awesome. Yes. Rick said yes, definitely you should put
good
photos in. Yeah.
And those certainly jog the memory as well.
Well, it does. And also it gives it I love it because I like to see people's photographs. It gives you an idea of them as people.
Yes.
You know, and their backgrounds and what they look like as a kid and, you know, what their kids look like or whatever. I think a little of that, I think, is interesting.
Fantastic. Where do you feel that you are in the process? If we were to put a line on the chalkboard insofar as completing the book, right now, do you think you're at 60, 70, 80%? Where are you?
How about the six last final pages?
That's amazing. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So then you'll continue to use this very, very clever and eclectic process to get your handwritten or oral history into the computer.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, every day I do some, so it doesn't pile up too much, you know. Mm. And then I keep it on the computer and edit it and put it into a folder. You hear all these words I'm using, my goodness.
Yes.
A folder in there that will eventually go to Rick and keep here. And believe me, in the process, I have lost a little information along the way. You know, I've deleted something. I thought, oh, no, don't tell me. Don't. I have to do it again. Not too many of those, but once or twice I did. Luckily, not too much. But, yes, those things happen.
Then going from author to promoter, any thoughts as to when the book may begin to become, if you will, promoted to the world?
It should be before later in the year, I think.
Okay, fantastic.
So that's, you know, once I finish these pages, which hopefully I may even finish today or tomorrow at the latest. And then you've got the other things, the photographs. I've sorted quite a few, but there are a few more to come, and which I have to go through some more. And, you know, just general bits that you've got to apparently put in and put together.
Right.
But then it'll all go to Rick, and then it's in his hands, and we see how we go through. I've never had a book, so I don't know quite what you do from there. We'll just wait, so you know, I will let you know, of course, when we have dates and things.
That is fantastic, because we will want to make certain, both on websites and our social media, to let all the community know that the book is coming and where to be able to obtain it, because they'll want to read it, and I'm certain because of the tangibility, want to keep a copy, have a copy for their library. Well, I am thrilled to know that the book is coming soon, and I will be one of the first purchasers and readers, and we will share this out with all of our community. Please keep us posted, and I hope on other themes, if we may, we'll chat another day about things in your career, in your life, maybe touch base about The Prisoner or last September when you all went to Port Marion. But for today, mm-hmm. I totally appreciate the conversation. I thank you for sharing the time with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's lovely to speak to you finally.
Greetings, Village Cast listeners. This is Rick Davey, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at the Eternal Village event on September the 9th. Until then, be seeing you in Seattle.
Your attention. Your attention, please. Will the members of the Commemoratives Committee please convene in the Village Archives? Good citizens, The Eternal Village Cast is delighted to share a conversation with the esteemed broadcaster, prolific comic book author, and lifelong Prisoner fan, Mr. Mark Rayner.
So, Mark, thank you so much for joining us in this, what I know will be a fun conversation about you, the prisoner, and the obsessive nature of tangible things. How are you today?
Good to talk to you, Carl. I love the prisoner and had fun at your prisoner event last year.
Good. Well, let's help the audience and both of us. Tell me, in your story, when was the first time? How did you discover this interesting, crazy little program that was only showed on TV a couple times when we were young? How did you find The Prisoner?
Well, I discovered The Prisoner at exactly the right, or maybe exactly the wrong age. I had already been a fan of Star Trek and all the 60s shows, The Wild Wild West, everything that was around The Prisoner at the time. But it wasn't until college that a sort of surrogate father figure turned me on to The Prisoner at a time when I just really needed it at that point of my intellectual development, because it was all about, nonconformity and willpower and individuality.
Yep.
And it stuck with me. It imprinted on me and it stuck with me after that.
Now, back in those days, how were you seeing the show? Was this videotape, Laserdisc? How did you access it?
It's shadows projected on a cable. It was a friend of mine who was like the neighborhood techie, and he had, I think, all the episodes on videotape, and we'd watch one or two in a week and talk about them. And then I went away for a year to live in Scotland and go to school in Scotland, and I didn't get to see the end of the show until I got back, and it was torture. It was torture, but we finally got to the end, and as you know, the end is just mind-blowing.
Yes. Some may say the end is just the beginning, but yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Now, that started a love for it, and you already said that it was built in the idea that it tapped into you at a time when those themes of individualism or the idea of rebellion. But all these years later, or not that many years later, why is this still a program that you would be passionate to tell somebody about or talk about or go to a silly event and watch people talk about it? How come it still speaks to you?
Well, I mean, I think it's needed now more than ever, for God's sakes. Like, if I could show The Prisoner to every Fox News viewer, I think the world might be a little bit of a better place, don't you?
Can't we hack into their signal one night and just play free-for-all?
I don't know. I think they might be lost causes. But, you know, it's weird to me that everybody knows Star Trek chapter and verse and all those shows from that era. But there are a fair number of people who still don't know about The Prisoner when you bring it up. And then, you know, the immediate next thing you say is just stop talking to me right now and go get it and watch all of them. Yeah. And you're going to thank me later. So I've found myself being a real evangelist for The Prisoner over the years.
That's fantastic. Because I agree. People who are in, let's say, the genre or in the realm of enjoying things that are of a sci-fi or a fantasy, it does surprise me when I say to them, well, you, of course, have heard of this, right? And they glaze over. And I think, but in today's world with websites and all the access, how come they don't have this encyclopedic idea of what at least has been there?
Well, but I guess I'll tell you, it's right now, this week, it's the 50th anniversary of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. And I think of The Prisoner not too dissimilarly from that, in that it was more enigmatic than your general audiences want. It doesn't wrap things up and answer questions. It was ahead of its time by a great deal. And, you know, Kubrick didn't like to over-explain things, and we know Patrick McGoohan certainly did not.
No. So, and also up until the recent era, the fact of the matter is, you know, blessed be, but shows that had a lot of episodes got into syndication. Something like The Prisoner, which had an awkward number of shows, it was very difficult. In Seattle, when I was growing up, the only station that played it was the PBS station. That was it. Nobody else would have it because it wouldn't fit into a schedule.
Yeah, that's a key pragmatic point. I mean, I think these days the threshold for syndication is 100 episodes. Star Trek, we know, was only 78 episodes, but they were in constant syndication. The Prisoner was only 17 episodes. And so, you know, even if you're on the Sci-Fi Channel and you're showing them once a week, that doesn't get you very far.
No,
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. So here's the background. We know when and we know why. Now I want to ask you, as you move along through life and there's things you love and things you cherish, why do you think why do we end up collecting things relative to that subject? Because so many people in today's world, I have friends who've gotten rid of every DVD they've ever had because their argument is, oh, it's all online.
Well, they're fools. Every one of them, they're fools.
I agree. I do agree. But what prompted you, because I'm sure you have more interests than just The Prisoner, what prompted you to say, I'm going to take some of my hard-earned money and I'm going to buy fill in the blank? Why?
Well, there are two answers. Number one is I'm a hoarder. And number two is that there's nothing to buy. There's a dearth of Prisoner stuff. And anybody who's a serious fan of The Prisoner knows that there was, and we'll get into more detail on this as we talk, but yeah, there was almost nothing made in the 60s. And now, you know, you can get some books and calendars and stuff. But, you know, compared to the other shows, there wasn't much at all. As for why anybody wants to collect this stuff, in addition to being a hoarder, any show that you love, especially these cult shows, they sort of, when you're finished with them, you want to partake of them more. If you love these things, you want more of it. You want to, you know, have things with the logos on it. I mean, I don't have that much of a background in psychology, but, you know, you want to surround yourself with the things you love. If you go to somebody's house and they don't have any books in it, you don't trust that person.
So
if I go to somebody's house and I see, say, a Prisoner book or the Prisoner Blu-rays on their shelf, I think, oh, well, here's somebody I have something in common with and may now have sex with.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it speaks to the sense that what it does is it says out loud without words, this is something I cherish. This is a part of me. Because, again, I think if you disagreed with it, it wouldn't be on your shelf. If you loathed it, you probably wouldn't put it in your space. But we surround ourselves with things that ultimately are things I think we take energy from. So,
sure. And you want to read, you want to rewatch it. You want to read about it. You want to read about the making of it. If you love a thing, a show like this, you pretty much want to get your hands on everything you can. I mean, I brought up Kubrick in 2001. I think I have every imaginable 2001 book or item that was ever created, because you just want to get everything you can get your hands on if it's a beloved piece of literature or film or TV.
The idea of being the completist. Okay. Well, let's talk.
I think a really good show
kind
of turns people into obsessives. Maybe that's the mark of a quality show, because you don't see people obsessively collecting. I mean, like, name a crap show that you don't care for now. I don't want to upset anybody.
Right.
There are so many shows that have long runs, but that there's no memorabilia at all for them, because it was just kind of stuff to fill the time. And you could never, ever say that about The Prisoner.
Yeah, I don't think that the world famous, like, Touched by an Angel or most of the NCIS series, as great as they were and they've been on TV, I don't think they bred a lot of merchandise. No, I agree with you on that.
No, and just one other point is that The Man from U.N.C.L.E. say that had more merchandise than any show ever. And I've got a lot of that too, but it was a kid's show. James Bond, also tons and tons of merchandise, but whatever you think about James Bond, it was sort of a boy's adventure show. The Prisoner wasn't a kid's show, and consequently, it wasn't marketed to make a lot of stuff for kids to collect. And a lot of the things that we collect now, I mean, this is us fulfilling some childhood thing that we had. If you want to go the Jean-Paul Sartre route, we're filling the emptiness at the core of our being with things we wanted as children but couldn't have until we were adults and could afford them. I'll also just speculate here, but I think that merchandising might even have been against the values of Number Six and Patrick McGoohan. I mean, McGoohan always seemed to me to want us to appreciate the show for what it was and have that experience and not talk it to death afterward either. So I think that just merchandising the living daylights out of this show may not have been a thing he was even remotely interested in.
What is your response to all of the analysis and all of the philosophizing and criticism of the series, people have tried to make so much of it and to find so many levels of meaning and to parse it in so many directions.
I'm astonished. For instance, the beautiful presentation, a thing that you prepared for our good friends here, puts profounder meanings into many of the stories than I ever thought of.
Or more pompous.
Yeah. No, not at all. No. I think it's marvelous. I'm most gratified.
If we were to look in at your collection, let's start with the most important thing. You said, again, you like to have a lot of versions. Do you have different versions of the show on different media or iterations of it?
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, you know, I was talking about the same thing with another person who was a George Romero Living Dead aficionado. And I think I have about a dozen different iterations of Dawn of the Dead on Laserdisc and whatnot, VHS special editions. Now, there aren't that many iterations of The Prisoner, but no. I think I have every single one of those too. And most recently, of course, the Blu-ray, which looks wonderful.
God. Have you thought about buying the new one that Network released for the 50th anniversary, the new box set that has apparently a new documentary, that kind of thing?
I didn't know about it, and damn you for just telling me.
Sorry.
I don't know. I mean, you do sort of reach a point of redundancy. Like, I just got the Outer Limits Season 1 Blu-ray box set, and I love it so much that I want to move to Vermont and marry it. But, I mean, you got to wonder when the upgrading stops, yes. You know?
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, and we'll check this, that in the box set that Network put out for the anniversary, kindly, they made it a package where you could buy all the episodes plus the extras. But I believe they've actually put out a single disc that is just the extras, which I think is a very nice gesture because me, I'm the opposite. I am a minimalist. I would look at it and go, but I have a set of DVDs. What's version different in another? Right. But the extras do appeal to me. So that I think is on my wish list.
I think I have OCD probably to a much greater degree than you do. So I'm probably going to have to get that and add it myself next to all my other stuff. And that's the way I am. And it's too late to start apologizing for it.
Don't. And remember, like they say, nobody likes a quitter. So the shows itself are one facet. What about the written word? What type of books have you been able to put your hands on to put in your collection over these years?
Well, there were a series of novels written back in the 60s, and I believe most of them were written by Thomas Dish, the sci-fi author. Mm-hmm. And I have those, and there were reprints issued, and I don't think I bothered with many of those because I had the original ones that had picture covers of Patrick McGoohan on those. There are quite a number of things. They have episode guides. They've got books about the village. You mentioned a book of prisoner scripts. There are two volumes of that I have. In fact, let me just walk with my laptop over to my bookshelf here. Calendars. There have been quite a number of prisoner calendars. What have we got here? The Official Prisoner Companion.
Yes. Yes. Written by Robert. Yep.
We've got The Prisoner, another official companion that's meant to go with a DVD. The Prisoner in Port Marion by Robert Langley. The Prisoner, a hardcover book by Alain Karas and Helene Oswald. There are a lot of books, and they're all Latter-day books. As I said, there really wasn't much put out at the time at all. And when you talk about merchandise, you know what's funny is there wasn't going to be a prisoner gun because he didn't have one. So like Uncle and James Bond, where there are tons and tons of guns that boys could play with and become maladjusted for the rest of their lives. There really wasn't any, like, what are you going to give to a kid from The Prisoner? Like, look, buddy, here's a Rover.
Yeah.
It's a weather balloon. And so the only real prisoner toy back at the time of the show was put out by Dinky Toys, and it was the Mini Moke, that golf thing that they rode around in the village.
Yes.
I don't have one of those because they're very hard to come by, and even sort of a rotten one in lousy shape it'll run you $300-$400.
Oh, they're extremely expensive. I'm shocked at how much those people are able to trade for. Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying I don't want one.
Yes.
They are prohibitively expensive. Yeah. Now, related to the prisoner, there was Danger Man, and there was a little bit of merchandise for Danger Man. And as anybody listening to your podcast knows, Danger Man is the show McGowan did before The Prisoner. Mm-hmm. And whether or not you think it's the same character, I don't know. That's kind of an angels on the head of a pin debate that I don't care about. But there was a board game for Danger Man. Which I have. There were a handful of the hardcover British children's annuals, comic book annuals from Danger Man. I have some of those. And I think, were there cards? I don't remember. I've lost track. But there are also CDs of the music of The Prisoner. Yes. I think there were three or four of those, and I have all of those. And I just discovered another one that I was about to order that was the library music.
That's the box set where it shows him on the cover with the headphones on.
It's sort of an odd shape. I don't recall what's on the cover.
Yeah, it's I have that. And it is, this is where we kind of go off into that micro attention, because it's not even music, it's musical stings and musical what's the term for it, interstitials in the show.
And so yet I have to have that. I must have that. I require that.
Okay.
Yeah, I won't be able to rest until I have that. Listen, I don't know if you've ever been to the Village. Have you been to Port Marion?
I have not. No, I have not.
Some Prisoner fans have made the trek, and I was one of them, and it takes some doing to get there. Because it's well off the beaten path, and you've got to either drive or get driven hours from any major point there. So I went there, and it looks exactly like it does in the show, The Village.
Right.
And the place that was number 6's cottage on the show is a gift shop. And you'd better believe that I tried on a number 6 black blazer with white piping in the gift shop. And, you know, they have other things like postcards with images from the show and pins. And I, in fact, went to the beach that's in the prologue to the show, the credit seat or whatever you call it, where McGowan, number 6, is running along the beach, mm-hmm. being chased by a rover.
Mm-hmm.
I made my girlfriend film me running along that same beach.
Perfect.
So that later on I could edit it into stuff from the show.
That is perfect.
Nobody's ever going to listen to this, right?
No, I promise we'll never let this one out. No, we'll never. This will just be in the archive.
Okay, good.
So I know the jacket, that's a temptation, pricey. Did you get anything unique from the gift shop? Because I've actually ordered a few things from them online that I really love. Did you take away anything from there?
You know, when it comes right down to it, my tastes are a little bit more pedestrian than some of my other nerd friends. I do a Geek Nation podcast with a couple other guys, and they'll wear clothes like Star Trek clothes or buy Marvel Infinity Gauntlet mugs. And I'm more the book and movie and poster kind. Like, I've got a vast collection of film posters, but there were none of those for The Prisoner.
Right.
So, you know, my collection is, I wouldn't say it's what you'd see in a grown-up's house, but you know, I don't have a lot of action figures or anything like that.
Yeah, I agree. It's funny. I don't have a single T-shirt. I am not the kind of person who needs the world as I walk down the street to kind of instantly know what I'm into. The thing that I ordered from the store that I carried for the longest time was a reusable shopping bag, and it was absolutely beautiful. It was full color with the Prisoner logo on both sides. And I have to tell you, in the time that I had it, because it's a shopping bag, it didn't last forever, people would actually stop me and ask me, what is that? Now, they had, like you said, no reference point, but the imagery of it was so strong that people were curious, and they would say, well, what? And it would open up conversation. But that was my sort of green way of bringing The Prisoner to the store with me all the time.
Well, yeah, you're only helping people. Now, I've got at least one friend, probably more, who has a Prisoner tattoo. You got any of those, Carl?
Well, the only one I know of, by person, of course, is Tim Palgut, who was at the event with us last year. Tim has a very, I would say, very stoic and very detailed one, and I think it is his left upper arm, left bicep.
And what is it of? Is it of the Penny Farthing?
No, it's a combination where it's the number six. It's Patrick McGowan's face, but it's also within the shape, kind of a I don't know how to describe it, but it's a multiplicity of images within one thing in that upper part of his arm.
Sure, yeah. Sure. I've never loved a show enough to get a tattoo of it, but if I were going to get one, it would be of the prisoner.
Well, what I hope to do then is, as we move towards the event, we'll touch base on this theme again, and maybe a few things in your collection, if you would be willing and wish to, we'll put into the display, the collection we're going to have for people to see at the event. And who knows, between now and then, apparently I've talked you into buying a whole nother set of DVDs that could be.
Yeah, thanks for that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. You're welcome. In the meantime, thank you for sharing the time with us, and we hope to see you in person in September, but talk to you possibly on other themes in between now and then.
You bet, Carl. Thank you. Good talking to you again, and as they say, be seeing you.
All villagers are encouraged to share their thoughts and contributions with the Eternal Village Cast. Please send your remarks care of info@theeternalvillage.org. Until our next program, be seeing you.